pull up a chair. I want to tell you about a sound, or really, the absence of one. Picture a German soldier on the Eastern Front. It's the dead of night, winter of 1942, somewhere south of Stalingrad. He's cold in a way you and I have never been cold, and he's listening, because he's learned to listen. There's a soft hiss up in the dark, like wind through canvas, like somebody sweeping a floor a long way off, and then his world comes apart in fire and splinters. He never heard an engine. That's the part that got into their heads. He never heard it coming. This is Radio Hangar. I'm Tail Dragger, and this is The Hangar. And today we are going to talk about the bravest crop dusters who ever lived. Before we get rolling, a quick word about the folks keeping the lights on here. Today's show is brought to you by AviationSoul.com, aviation challenge coins for every milestone in flight. First solo private pilot instrument rating, all the way up the ladder. If you've earned it, they've got a coin for it, and every one of those coins tells a story. Now, the women I'm about to tell you about never got a coin. They barely got a thank you, so maybe carry one for them. Check them out at AviationSoul.com. All right, let me set the scene properly. When the Germans invaded the Soviet Union in 1941, the Soviet Union was bleeding pilots faster than it could train them, and there was a woman named Marina Raskova. Now, in the Soviet Union at that time, Marina Raskova was as famous as any flyer alive. She'd set long-distance records, she was a household name. Think of what Amelia Earhart was to America. That's what Raskova was to the Russian people. And young women all across the country were writing her letters, thousands of letters, wanting to fight, wanting to fly. And most of the brass wanted nothing to do with the idea, but Raskova had the ear of Stalin himself. And in October of 1941, permission came down to form three air regiments crewed entirely by women. Pilots, navigators, mechanics, armorers, every single job, top to bottom, done by women, that had never happened anywhere in the world. Not in Britain, not here in the States, not anywhere. The one we're talking about today became the 588th Night Bomber Regiment. Now here's where it gets interesting. You'd figure a frontline bomber outfit gets frontline airplanes, right? Something fast, something with some armor and some guns. Pull up a chair, because that is not what they got. What they got was the Polikarpov Po-2. Let me tell you about the Po-2. It was a biplane. Two wings, wood frame wrapped in doped fabric. Open cockpits, two of them, one behind the other. It was designed back in the 20s as a basic trainer and a crop duster. This was the airplane you learned to fly in. This was the airplane that dusted the collective farms. It had a little radial engine that put out all of about 110 horsepower on a good day, and it cruised at maybe 60 miles an hour. You heard me right, 60. There are cars in the school pickup line faster than that. No radio, no guns to speak of, no armor, no parachutes, not in the early days. The navigator in the back sat there with a map, a flashlight, a compass, and a pencil, and they hung bombs off the lower wings, a couple hundred pounds, sometimes more, which on an airplane that size is a lot to ask. Now, if you're a pilot listening to this, your first thought is the same as mine was. That airplane is a death sentence over a battlefield. A modern fighter would run it down like a hawk on a sparrow. And that, friends, is exactly the secret. Because that ridiculous, obsolete, slow little biplane turned out to be nearly impossible to shoot down. And here's why. The German fighters, the Messerschmitts, they had a stall speed higher than the Po-2's top speed. Think about that. To even aim at one of these biplanes, the German pilot had to slow down so much he was on the ragged edge of falling out of the sky himself, and the little Polikarpov could turn inside anything. It could practically pivot on a wingtip. So a fighter would come screaming through, take one snapshot, and blow right past, and by the time he hauled around for another go, that biplane had slipped down into the trees and the ground clutter where the fighter's guns couldn't find it. And the wood and fabric construction. Cannon shells designed to blow apart an aluminum airplane would punch clean through fabric and never go off. The airplane came home looking like a screen door and flew again the next night. So these women took the most useless airplane on the field and turned it into a weapon nobody could stop. But they had to be clever about how they used it. And this is the part I love. They flew at night, always at night, and they worked out a technique that gave them their name. They'd fly in groups of three. Two airplanes would go in first and get the searchlights and the anti-aircraft guns all lit up and chasing them. They'd jink and weave and draw all that fire, all those fingers of light swinging across the sky. And while everybody on the ground was busy shooting at those two, the third airplane had already cut its engine, cut it, dead stick, gliding, silent. She'd come down out of the black sky with nothing but the wind sighing through the wires and the wing struts, drop her bombs right on the target, and then fire that little engine back up and slip away into the dark. Then the three of them would rotate. Your turn to be the bait, my turn to glide. And that sound, that soft rushing hiss of an unpowered biplane gliding in over their heads in the dark. The German troops said it sounded like a witch's broomstick sweeping across the sky, so they started calling them the Nachtthexen. The Night Witches. The women heard about it, and they loved it. They took that name and wore it like a medal. Let me tell you what a night of work actually looked like, because this is the part the history books rush past. They flew from rough dirt strips close to the front. They take off in the dark, no lights, feeling for the airplane. Once they were up, the pilot up front, the navigator in back, freezing in that open cockpit. 20-30 degrees below zero with the wind of flight tearing at them. Some of these girls got frostbite so bad on their faces and hands that it stayed with them the rest of their lives. And here's the thing that stops me cold every time. A single mission was maybe 30-40 minutes. And because the airplane was so small and could only carry so little, they didn't fly one mission a night. They flew 8, 10 some nights on a short run to a closed target, 18 sorties before dawn, 18 times up into the flak and the searchlights, 18 times gliding silent over men who wanted them dead, and in between you'd land in the dark, and the ground crew, all women too, would come running. They'd rearm the bombs by hand, hang them back on the wings in the freezing mud, top off the fuel, and shove you back into the sky. 4 minutes on the ground some nights, 4 minutes, and back up into it. There was a young pilot named Nadezhda Popova. She flew for this regiment, and she once flew 18 missions in a single night. She said later that she could not understand how she was still alive. One night she came back and counted the holes in her airplane. She'd been hit by so much shrapnel she gave up counting. She said the fabric of her machine was riddled, and there was a hole through her helmet, and her map was shot to pieces in her hands. And the airplane still flew. She patched it and went back up. They had no guns to shoot back with. All they could do was fly into it, drop the load, and fly out. Night after night after night, for years. And they were good. Lord, were they good. This regiment flew something on the order of 23,000 sorties over the course of the war. 23,000, they dropped thousands of tons of bombs on German positions, supply dumps, bridges, encampments. They harassed those troops so relentlessly, night after sleepless night, that German commanders put a bounty on them. Any pilot who shot one down got an automatic Iron Cross. And for a long time, the Germans genuinely believed these had to be elite, handpicked criminals, or that the women had been given some special injections to give them cat's eyes in the dark. The truth was simpler and a whole lot more human. They were mostly girls in their late teens and early 20s. University students, school teachers, farm kids. They painted flowers on the sides of their airplanes. They used their navigation pencils to do their eyebrows before a mission, because if you're going to fly into hell, you might as well look like yourself doing it. They danced and sang between raids on the airfield. And then the flare would go up and they'd climb into those open cockpits and go back to war. More than 30 of them died. Some shot down, some lost in weather, in that filthy, unforgiving Eastern Front weather, flying an airplane with no instruments to speak of, no radio to call for help, no way home but a compass and a flashlight and their own nerve. For a long stretch of the war, they flew without parachutes, because the bosses decided the weight of the extra fuel and bombs mattered more. So if your airplane caught fire over the target, and a fabric airplane catches fire in a hurry, you wrote it down. They knew that when they took off, and they took off anyway. The regiment earned the title of a Guards Unit. It became the 46th Guards Night Bomber Regiment, a battlefield honor. Better than 20 of these women were named heroes of the Soviet Union, the highest honor the country had. They flew all the way from the Caucasus to the edge of Berlin. They were there at the end. Now let me connect this to why we're all sitting here. We love to talk about the fast iron in this hobby. The Mustangs and the Spitfires and the Jets. I'm as guilty as anybody. I get weak in the knees over a Merlin engine. But every so often you run across a story that reminds you what the airplane actually is. It's a lever. It's a place to stand. Give a determined human being even the worst airplane on the field, an unarmed fabric trainer that a fighter should swat out of the sky in a heartbeat, and the right hands will turn it into something the enemy loses sleep over. Those women didn't have the airplane. They didn't have the guns, the armor, the parachutes, or the respect. What they had was the stick, the rudder, and the will to fly it into the dark 18 times before breakfast. And I think about that on a smooth VFR morning, when I'm grumbling about avgas prices and airspace and paperwork. Back when avgas was cheap and airspace was free, we'd have called ourselves lucky. Those girls flew into anti-aircraft fire in a crop duster with a flashlight and a prayer, and they'd have given anything for a quiet Saturday and a full tank. If you want to read more about them, and you should, the Night Witches are written up beautifully in the accounts historians have gathered from the survivors, in the archives at the Aviation Museums, and in the record left by Nadezhda Popova herself, who lived a long life and never stopped telling people what those nights were really like before she passed. Go find their story. It'll change the way you look at that little tail dragger tied down at the end of your ramp. You can find us at RadioHangar.com if you want to say hello or tell me whose story we ought to tell at TET next. For now, though, next time you hear the wind sighing through the wires on a quiet approach, throttle back, gliding in over the numbers, think about who else heard that sound, and be glad the only thing waiting for you at the far end of the runway is a cup of coffee. This is Tail Dragger. Keep the shiny side up.